This episode of Boat Briefing is sponsored by Amico & Co. Based in Genoa, at the heart of the Mediterranean, Amico & Co. is a family-owned refit yard with more than two centuries of maritime heritage behind it. Today, the yard is widely recognised for its work on large yachts, offering a full-service refit capability delivered largely through its own in-house teams, from paint and engineering to complex conversions and structural projects. Rooted in one of Europe's great historic port cities, Amico combines tradition, technical depth, and long-term thinking, making it a trusted partner for owners, captains, and shipyards alike.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Big Boat Interview. I'm Lucy Dunn, the Content Director of Boat International, and today I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest, Hanley Prinsloo. Hanley is a world record freediver from South Africa. She's held her breath for over 6 minutes, swum with sharks and dolphins, and dived to depths most of us can barely imagine. And she now dedicates her life to connecting people with the ocean, especially the next generation, through her truly inspiring conservation initiative, the I Am Water Ocean Conservation Foundation. Hanley is going to be a speaker at our forthcoming Oceana Talks event on the 11th of June, an event I, for one, am very much looking forward to. Hanley, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
So let's get straight down to business. You're an 11-time freediving record holder, is that right?
That's right.
So tell me, you didn't actually grow up by the ocean, did you? So how did you get to become what you are now?
Yeah, it's always an interesting and winding journey from where I started to where I am now. I grew up on a horse farm outside Pretoria in South Africa. And even though today I'm known as an ocean person, I think from very, very early on, I've always been a nature person. And that stillness and wilderness that I grew up in definitely set the course for my life. And as I desired more and more and deeper nature connection, that's where the ocean started answering that call. So as a child, you know, it was a big wild African horse farm. We climbed trees, we rode bareback on horses. There were fireflies everywhere. You could see the whole Milky Way. And our rules were come home before the sun sets and don't die. And those were two very good guidelines for life. I think telling a young child don't die from a very early age teaches you a kind of risk mitigation that has served me very well in my adult life as a freediver who's gone for depth, who's gone for swimming with big animals, lots of sharks, etc. It's like, is this dangerous? Definitely. Will I die? No. Excellent. Let's do this, you know. So I think that's definitely charted my path. And I discovered freediving in Sweden, of all places. I was studying in Gothenburg and met a freediver who took me diving in a fjord, and I just discovered that stillness. And that I was 19, and that pivoted everything I thought I knew about myself, everything I thought I knew about our planet, and has set the course for where I'm headed and where I've been.
You didn't sort of segue into it with scuba diving, you just straight into freediving.
I actually did my open water one when I was 18 in Mozambique with my sister. And I'll never forget, because my sister is part of this journey in that as young girls, we dreamt of being mermaids. And we had this mermaid language on the farm where we would click and squawk and squeak at each other underwater. I now realize we were never speaking mermaid language. We were speaking some kind of dolphin dialect. But it was like my sister and I had these mermaid dreams. And she said to me the other day, you always say how we dreamt of being mermaids when we were kids. You do realize we grew up in like brown farm dams in Africa. We were barbel. We were catfish. We were never mermaids. And so she actually won a scuba diving experience for two. So we went to Mozambique together and I did scuba diving and I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be it. You know, us two mermaids going diving. And we both found it so frustrating. Like the equipment, the way it limited our movement, you couldn't move up and down the water column as you want to. You had to be more static at the bottom. And I think that childhood dream of moving through the water like some kind of aquatic nymph did not happen for me in scuba diving. And so I had like a quick little dip into scuba diving, realized this is not for me. And so when I discovered freediving, it was a big aha moment. I still scuba dive today if it really is a place where scuba is the thing that makes sense. For example, on Cocos Island, where it's a deep dive and lots of current and, you know, lots of sharks in the water column and you can't dive straight up and down because of the current, that's a great place for scuba diving and like hooking onto the reef. But most places, I just want to be moving up and down.
Okay, so tell me about free diving in a, I suppose free diving is just free diving without scuba, but and tell me in a competitive sense, what does that mean?
So competitive freediving, the easiest way to describe it is you compete is in distance underwater, depth or time. And there's various disciplines within those three categories. So in time, it's straightforward. You float face down holding your breath. Wildly boring, mentally very taxing, and absolutely not a spectator sport. 100%.
Mm. Oh, hey, Bubba. Here's a little visitor. Say hi, Lucy.
Hello.
How are you doing, Edda? Ethan is also a little free diver, aren't you, Edda? What kind of sea creature are you?
Sea lion.
A sea lion? Yes, you are. Now, little sea lion, can you close the door, please?
Thank you.
Okay, so that's my little sea lion who came to visit. So that's static apnea, floating face down in the water, holding your breath. Then there's distance underwater. So we have, that's called dynamic apnea. So either swimming as far as possible in a swimming pool with fins or without fins, monofin or bifins. And then we have depth. And depth can be pulling down the rope and back up again, free immersion. Swimming no fins, breaststroke down and back up again, constant weight, no fins. Constant weight with fins, monofin down, monofin up, bifins down, bifin up. Or two disciplines where we are assisted, going down with a weighted sled and up with an air balloon, or down with a weighted sled and swimming or pulling back up, variable weight. And those were never my favorites. I always preferred being within my own body's capacity, not relying on equipment, because that to me is the beauty of freediving. So competitive freediving has developed a lot in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. You know, there's a lot more competitions. There's a lot more divers. Many people are going beyond the 100-meter mark, which also raises a little bit of a three-digit ego thing. And so I feel like competitive freediving has become a little fraught for me. Whereas before, when I was competing, it was really, we were all just a bunch of happy amateurs figuring out what the human body could do. Now, like a lot of the research has been done, there's even sponsors, you know, it's become a little bit more of a sport. So I've definitely pivoted now in my personal life more to using the skills and principles competitive freediving taught me, but using those in organization building, business, the business world, my own personal development, and of course, how I explore and interact with the ocean. So freediving has given me very many gifts, but not any more expressed in the competitive realm.
And how does it feel physically and mentally being down? I mean, the furthest you went, 65 meters, is that correct?
That's right.
That right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So how does it feel physically and mentally?
Mentally, if we are within our limits and well prepared, it's a very calm and connected moment. It's such stillness and such presence, such absolute like needle sharp presence. Of course, if you're not well prepared, it's stressful mentally. And then you have to be working with overcoming that anxiety. But in my world, I would then just, that's not a day for diving deep. If I can't be calm in my mind, then that is not a day for diving deep. So my experience has always been that in those depths, I feel very calm, very focused, very connected. And physically, you know, our lungs, our body becomes compressed in water as we dive down. So you feel that pressure building and it's like a squeeze. And I always told myself the story that the deeper I dive, the tighter the ocean hugs me. So for me, it's definitely been a journey both into self mentally and emotionally, and then physically that very connected, loving, embracing experience of the ocean.
You don't feel fear, or do you feel, is it very solitary?
It is solitary, but, you know, because of the way we increase our depth, which is a very slow progression, right? I don't just wake up one day and think, I feel really good today. I'm just going to like bomb out 65 meters. You know, it's not how it works. It's like I worked for those from 20 to 25 to 30 to 32 to 34. Like it takes a long time. So by the time I'm going to 65, I really should not have any fear. It should feel very doable and very, I almost want to say, obvious, if that makes sense. So I really feel like when freediving is practiced properly, of course, there's a sense of anticipation like there is in any achievement, but not fear and not anxiety. If one's pushing into that, then you're playing a dangerous game.
And what drives you to get that depth? I mean, is it a competitive spirit or is it that feeling that you want to feel part of the ocean? What drove you particularly?
I think some people for sure, you know, it can be very rewarding, intoxicating, addictive, whatever, to be the best at something, right? But for me, I'm not a very competitive person generally, but I'm very motivated. And I was just fascinated by what my body could do and fascinated by being able to improve, to have a feeling of like, I cannot go deeper than 30 meters. And then I tweak my diet, I tweak my training, I do some more lung stretching, I, you know, practice with my coach, and suddenly I'm doing 35. I'm like, well, what else is possible? So it's like that, what else is possible that I really enjoy? And I still do. Like, that's definitely still a very big part of my life. I am a risk taker in that way. Like, what else is possible? But I don't like being fearful and anxious. So I'm also very aware of limitations. So I think that's what makes me different maybe to some other freedivers, and definitely makes many of us freedivers very different to other adrenaline sports people. Like, we would often get clumped together with, just because it's perceived risk, it'll be like Alex Honnold and base jumpers and, like, you know, free soloing. And it's like, no. We are literally practicing deep mindfulness in the ocean, and when done properly, there is zero risk. And that's, I think, often the misconception with freediving.
Okay. And you talk about breath being a superpower. What do you mean by that, and how can people use that in everyday life?
Breath is such an underutilized opportunity, I think would be the way to put it, that, you know, we are born from water into this world where we have to breathe to survive. And at first we cry because we don't like leaving the watery world we come from after 9 months. And then we use this breath day in and day out. And we're much better at breathing when we babies. When you watch a baby sleep and their belly is rising and falling and they're breathing with their whole lung capacity. And then as we get older and we are upright and we have anxiety, which presses on our chest, or we sit slumped forward, you know, we start breathing with a fraction of our lungs and we become bad breathers. And, you know, the whole nose versus mouth breathing, you know, there's a lot around breath that used to be very intrinsic to the human physiology that we've become bad at. And the opportunities breathing well offers us is that we can regulate our nervous system. You know, we can take ourselves very quickly from a few breaths through like a slow inhale through the nose and a slow exhale through the nose or the mouth. Doing that 3, 4, 5 times, you can slow down your heart rate, activate your parasympathetic nervous system, completely reset, and be able to be a much more grounded person. And, you know, if you think of spiraling in temper, in, you know, having 2 small children and sleep deprivation and everything, the amount of times I have to really use my breath to center myself. You know, my little girl would sometimes, I hear herself chatting to herself when she's playing with her toys and something's not working. She goes, deep breath, Ava. And she's like regulating and focusing, you know, and she just knows that. So I think that's superpower, you know. And then increasing our lung volume. When I started freediving, my lungs were 4 liters. They're over 6 liters now. And oxygen is the fuel of our everyday. So even just harnessing how much better and how much bigger we could breathe, we could increase our brain capacity, our physical capacity, our sporting capacity. There's so much more we can harness through breath.
And yes, isn't it that you have to breathe through your nose? Is that right? More that, yeah. we're not breathing through our nose enough.
Absolutely. I mean, to the extent where, you know, the researchers who've done this, and James Nestor, who wrote about it in Breath, literally taped his mouth at night and did cycling things with the mouth taped and stuff. And the research shows breathing through our mouth has changed our facial bone structure, our jaw. It's like affected so much. And so how we eat, what we eat, like it's all connected. And so breathing through the nose is so important. And also the oxygen we take up, because there are receptors in the nasal passages that tell the lungs that there's oxygen coming. So you even take up oxygen better breathing through the nose. So there really are a lot of skills. You know, the body follows the path of least resistance. So whatever feels easiest, you know, if you're a little bit congested, just end up breathing through your mouth. So you could live your whole life slightly congested, not figuring out, why am I a little bit congested? Why can't I breathe through my nose? This is not good for me, you know. And rather addressing those core issues. So I do think that, I think at the end of the day, it's probably all around consciousness and, you know, being connected to our bodies, connected to our breath. Connect, for me, that connection part is a big key.
Okay. Fascinating. I need to sort of remember to breathe.
Yeah, and read. And I really highly recommend James Nestor, a US journalist author who wrote this book, Breath, fascinating. But he also wrote a very beautiful book about free diving, and it's called Renegade Science and What the Ocean Teaches Us About Ourselves. And this book is called Deep. And that's also a really beautiful portrayal of the human body in water, our relationship with the ocean, and beautifully told. So those are just two little book club recommendations.
Okay, thank you very much. I mean, you know, you've been underwater a lot. So tell me, you've had some extraordinary encounters underwater. So can you share, let's share one moment that stayed with you that you can, you know, that shaped who you are.
I'm lucky enough to have quite a few of those. And one of those I'll share more with when we meet in person as well. But one of my very first encounters with marine cetaceans, with whales and dolphins, was when I was still competing, and we were heading out on the boat in Mozambique to find deep water, to drop the rope and do some deep training. And the boat got surrounded by a big pod of spinner dolphins. And I'd never swum with dolphins before. And the skipper said, oh, no, they're spinner dolphins. They're not really interested in human interaction. Let's just keep going. But everything in me was like, I want to get in the water with them, you know, just their sleek bodies and those intelligent eyes peeking over the surface. And I put on my monofin and I said to the captain, please. And he stopped the boat and I just flipped off the back and took my breath as I was leaving the boat and just started kicking down with the monofin and just down, 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 down. And the dolphins, I think, were so surprised by not just like a snorkeler hovering at the surface that they all, as what, it was a super pod, like 100 dolphins, they all just turned and surrounded me like this vortex of silvery liquid gold coming around me. And they just followed me all the way down to the surface, like this swirling vortex of dolphins. And we hit the bottom, like got right to the bottom in like 30 meters or whatever it was. And the dolphins were all around. They were clicking and circling and chatting and scanning me and looking. And I just remember feeling this overwhelming sense of joy, just the joyfulness of these creatures and also the wildness, you know. And I've grown up in South Africa going on safari, seeing wildness, but you're in the vehicle, you know, you're in the car. You're not like, you know, lolloping with the wildebeest, right? It's like you are separated from that wild animal that you are surrounded by. And I was out the vehicle, you know, I was in this wilderness surrounded by these animals much bigger than me and just experiencing this joy, this connection, this playfulness, this power, this wildness that I'd never imagined before. And I just remember being down there swimming and seeing them around me and thinking, I would die for this wildness to remain, for these creatures to have this joy and this freedom, right? And that really impacted me so deeply. And, you know, I was 20 at the time, and just as I came off that experience and went and did my deep dives and everything, I was like, well, I've never actually experienced, like, I would die for this. Like, I've never, you know, had that thought before. And it sent me on a path of thinking, well, more useful would be, how could I live for this? Like, how could I work this into what is my purpose. And that was kind of a shift for me into a conservation mindedness around the ocean, as opposed to an adventure exploration mindedness. That was the start of that conservation journey. And I think it was a very early on, very, very personal just experience of that wildness and that freedom and that non-separateness, right? Like I was part of the pod.
Because you weren't, you know, when you're scuba diving, you can't hear. You wouldn't be able to hear the dolphins either. You've got...
Not in the same way. And they're generally not as curious around scuba divers, you know? We're like UFOs down there. And also dolphins breathe like a freediver does. So there's this kinship, whereas scuba divers breathe underwater. So dolphins are like, what's going on? That's weird, you know? So there really was that sense of kinship and that sense of moving together, how I was moving with my monofin and how they were moving. It was phenomenal. And I mean, to this day, I've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours in the water with dolphins by now, you know, 25 years later. And with little Ava, who you met earlier, when I was 7 months pregnant with her, so to segue to another life-changing moment, I got to go swim with a pod of bottlenose dolphin that I've swum with for over 10 years, annually, several times. I know them, they know me, like this is a thing we do, right? And I got in the water with them 7 months pregnant, and you know, dolphins through their echolocation and sonar, they can scan and see inside you. So they could see her. And being a matriarchal society, the pregnant female is royalty in dolphin world. So they surrounded me in a way and started scanning my belly and talking to the baby and how they click and direct their clicks and naming. And it was a completely different, like this wild, joyful experience I described earlier. This was very different, right? This was like the wise old ones and the curious younger females coming and looking at this other species baby inside. And they saw her when we hadn't even seen her. Sure, we've seen her on ultrasound, but that's through like a device. Whereas they, with their sonar, could just look at her and scan her, and they surrounded me, and the babies were like crowding onto me because they could feel that connection through the, you know, being pregnant. And I always have this knowledge that she heard them and they saw her before I'd even met her, you know. So it's a really special, I think it's that relationship with the marine creatures for me is, it's really deep. It is a kinship.
And that pod knew you. You said you've swum with it for 10 years so that they recognized you. And
100%, 100%. And I mean, dolphin research, you know, they name us, they name if they have names for each other. So, you know, I probably got in the water and they were like, oh my gosh, it's her, you know, and click, 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 click. And then went when they saw that I was pregnant, yeah. And just their whole behavior changed and how they came and started scanning my belly was phenomenal.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So, yes. Yeah, so that connection with the ocean, I mean, it, you know, that started your journey to set up your foundation, I Am Water Ocean Conservation Foundation. So tell me about the foundation. What was the impetus and inspiration for starting this?
Two of my greatest passions and purpose drivers have always been the ocean and my love for the ocean and protection thereof, but also a really strong social justice lens. You know, I grew up in South Africa in the 80s with a politically very aware family. So very conscious of the privilege I grew up in, very aware of the lack of access for so many South Africans. And in my 20s, I worked as a social political documentary filmmaker, really pursuing stories of social justice and human hope and yeah, in post-war zones and these kind of storytellings. And a lot of my healing and connection with self was always in the ocean while working in this quite harrowing field of work. And every time I came back to South Africa, because I would travel for my work as a filmmaker, I was studying in Sweden, I was competing in Egypt, you know, and every time I came back to South Africa, I would come and dive and go into the kelp forest and get in the ocean in South Africa. And notice again and again and again who's on the beach, who's getting in the water, like who is this ocean for? And during apartheid, our most beautiful nature spaces, from, you know, national parks to beaches to rivers to lakes, were whites only. So the ocean wasn't a place for everyone. And so there's transgenerational fear. There's a real disconnect from the ocean, even though today we don't have those political barriers anymore. The barriers that exist now are systemic, like people can't swim and they're not getting in the ocean. And coming back year after year, seeing it not changing, I'd never run an organization. I'd never worked with a nonprofit. But one thing I did know was how to take people into the ocean. I was a freediver. I was a freediving instructor. I taught a lot of courses, led expeditions. So I thought, well, I can do this. I can take people into the ocean. And so I started working with taking children to go and snorkel, and then realized, okay, I need to train more people to do this with me. We need to scale, and the people who are offering the workshop need to look like the children who come from these underserved communities. And so I found myself thrust into this world of organization building, program delivery, and starting an organization. And I started that in 2010. To date, now we have worked with over 50,000 children who had not had the opportunity to experience the ocean before. And we've built programs that bring young children from school to the beach, work with mindfulness, body breath connection, some yoga, and then do snorkeling, rocky shore exploration, beach walks, sharing circles, ocean literacy, knowledge development. So really working on learning about the ocean, by the ocean and in the ocean, but more than it being about just the sea, it's about themselves. Like, who are we? Who are we as humans on this beautiful blue planet? And how do we show up for ourselves, for nature, and really empowering young people in that way through overcoming fears? Yeah, that's what we do. And we also train a lot of young people in South Africa who are unemployed to be able to work in the blue and green job market. So we have a 1-year adventure-based learning training. And while they are training, they work as our facilitators so they can earn as they learn. We have an Ocean for All Alliance where we train other organizations around the world to do the ocean connection methodology we developed in Cape Town that we work with children. And this methodology has been studied by a university in the US, UNCW, that actually did an evidence-based study on behavior change and social-emotional learning and how young children change their behavior and their experience of the ocean through the workshop. So the organization is now very mature. We're delivering locally and globally, and I'm really proud of being able to build it to a place now where we create jobs and we open eyes underwater and do that work, because I really truly believe that I'm a big fan of science. I really am, and I love learning about the ocean, but facts and statistics alone do not change behavior. We have to bring in experience. We have to bring in heart-opening, transformational moments for people, young and old. But one of the hardest ones to do and one of the most impactful is children at an early age to bring this into their lives. So that's what we do with I Am Water.
How important is conservation in the message? Driving awareness, how important is the conservation message?
Oh, it's everything. It's everything. And it's all about, you know, also empowering that even though you might be an 11-year-old girl from an underserved community, you have the power to change this, the well-being of the ocean. Your actions matter. Your agency matters, you know. And I think that's really empowering for young people to feel like they can be part of the climate conversation and part of the solution and part of the conservation messaging. So it's very much that connection between empowering a young person to believe and believe they can be part of the conservation movement, but also have the tools to be impactful in that space.
And as you say, just hitting them with data and facts and, you know, fear-mongering doesn't work, does it?
If it worked, we wouldn't be where we are, right? Because we've done a lot of that. We know enough. It's getting out there. It's not like there isn't information out there. It's not like we can't reach every single human on the planet almost. Mm-hmm. It's just that it doesn't work. Whereas if you immerse people in nature and have these really transformational experiences, then it happens intuitively. And we have the evidence now to prove that. So really, I mean, the last 15 years have been very, very busy, but I'm very excited about the next.
Great. Okay. So tell me also, you have got ocean travel support, ocean travel as well. So tell me a little bit about that side. I assume that is supporting your nonprofit.
Absolutely. So, yes. So while I was competing, I was traveling quite a bit, working with different photographers and filmmakers with big animals. So whales, dolphins, sharks, etc. I think growing up on the horse farm gave me a very deep, my dad was a horse whisperer. And so this understanding of how we are with big animals came to me very early. You know, I could sit on a horse before I knew a horse wasn't me, right? And like how we interact with big animals. And I bring that into the ocean space when I'm working with dolphins or whales or sharks or people, for that matter, because we are also animals. And I would, you know, be speaking at conferences or something and have a photograph with a big whale or with a shark or something. And people would say to me, I want to do what you've done. I want to swim with, you know, a sperm whale, a whale shark, a manta ray. And I'd be like, well, for whale sharks, don't go to the Philippines because they feed them. For sperm whales, don't go to Mauritius because there's no legislation and they just chase them. Don't go, you know. And eventually somebody said to, and by then I was with my now husband, Peter, and he was a US team swimmer and underwater cameraman and everything. And we kept having these conversations. And somebody said, well, can't you just take us and do it right? And Peter and I looked at each other and we were like, I guess we can. So we started the travel company, and the travel company also worked as a fundraising mechanism for the nonprofit.
Okay.
Because, you know, for a nonprofit, the first years, you're always in this terrible catch-22 where it's like, we'll give you the money if you can prove the programs. Great. But we need to run the programs to prove the programs. Great. Well, as soon as you've proven the programs, we'll give you the money. And you're like, oh my gosh, you know, so like we need to bring in money so we can prove the programs kind of thing. So we started taking people on expeditions with big animals around the world. And we still do that with ocean travel. We've shifted our focus a little bit now with having two small children. So we do a lot of family ocean retreats, building confidence into families, like how to take young children safely into the ocean. And we still donate proceeds of the profit to Iron Water. And, you know, I think this kind of problem-solving mentality has always been a part of Peter and my way of looking at the world. So we, off the back of ocean travel, had a couple of clients who came on all of our trips with us who would, every time they went home, they'd say, it's been great, you know, thank you for bringing the equipment, because we would fly with carbon fiber fins and everything around the world. They're like, we want to buy our own equipment now. What should we buy? And we'd have the same thing. Well, don't buy this brand because the mast strap always breaks. Don't buy that because, you know, and so eventually they said, well, if we put the money on the table, can we develop the products you can actually recommend? And we're like, sure. So we started a brand. So Agalis is the first ever sustainable high performance freediving and snorkeling equipment that's fully sustainable, durable, repairable, etc. So who knows what's going to come next? But I always feel like my purpose is so simple for me, like connect people to the ocean. Iron Water is a very strong vehicle for that. Ocean travel is a very strong vehicle for that. And if we do what we do well, we're connecting people to the ocean, more people want to get into the ocean, then it's important to have the equipment that reflects our love for the ocean, so we're not damaging it while we're exploring, right? So that's always for me been, it's a very holistic view of how what I do with my time supports that true north.
Perfect. Okay. So what's one thing you wish people understood about the ocean?
I think, not for me, it's not so much the one thing I wish people understood about the ocean. I think it's really, I wish people would just be in the ocean more. Because everything we need to understand, everything that needs to happen, all of that comes when we enter the ocean in a specific way, you know, in that sense of coming home, in that sense of, you know, and I'm so non-judgmental, you know, whether people are wanting to cold water dip, if they're open water swimming, if they're surfing, if they're free diving, if they're scuba diving, it's like, this is 70% of our planet, you know, this is our home, right? And we come from water. So I think that's it, like understanding that we come from water. And you know, we have our mammalian dive response. Our body responds to being underwater the same way a whale and a dolphin's bodies respond. We have the same slowing down of the heart rate, constricting of the blood vessels, spleen response, releasing oxygen-rich hemoglobin into the blood. Like, we are seals, dolphins, like we are aquatic. So I think that is what I want people to understand, so that when they step back into the ocean, they feel that sense of coming home and belonging. Because when we feel like we are home and we belong and we deeply love this place, then protection, conservation is, it's just natural, right? Because we want to protect what we deeply love.
Hear, hear. Here's to mermaids. I'd like to be a mermaid.
You are. That's the point, Lucy. We are all of us. Mermaids, mermen, mer-thee, mer-them. It doesn't matter. Like, mermen, you know, we just need to get in the water.
Thank you, Hanley. That's so amazing. Really interesting. And I really look forward to seeing you on the 11th Ocean Talks. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy swimming.
Thank you.
Hanley, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. And thank you also to our unexpected special guest, Ethan, little Ethan. And thanks for all the amazing work you're doing. If you'd like to hear more, you can meet Hanley in person at Ocean Talks 2026 on the 11th of June. Now, in its ninth year, this annual event brings together the super yacht industry and leading voices in marine conservation for meaningful conversations, inspiring talks, and valuable networking opportunities. Held in partnership with the Ocean Family Foundation, this year's event introduces a new format designed to drive even greater impact and foster stronger connections. Visit boatinternational.com to apply for tickets. And that's all for this week's episode of Boat Briefing, a production of Boat International Media, sponsored by Amico & Co. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.